From ACB Radio Mainstream, welcome to Tuesday Topics. For the next hour, we will be discussing a topic of interest to blind and visually impaired people. And now, from Miami, Florida, the host of Tuesday Topics, Paul Edwards.
Good evening. I am Paul Edwards from Miami, Florida, and welcome to this week's Tuesday Topics. Let me begin by thanking our producer, Brian Charlson, and our erstwhile recorder and editor, Steve Bauer, who between them make of these programs something useful and valuable. I'd also like to, of course, thank all of those who are participating with us this evening in this recording, which I think we'll all find very interesting, and obviously would like to thank George Byes of Talking Communities, who has made this software available that allows us to do this recording. George, we really appreciate having the software available. We are privileged tonight to have as our guest someone who I have had the pleasure of knowing for an awfully long time, probably nearly 30 years, in fact. That gentleman is a professor of constitutional law at the University of Tennessee. Though he began his career as a pianist of some note and occasionally can be persuaded to demonstrate just what a good musician he is, Dr. Otis Stevens has written many books on constitutional law. And one of the highlights of our convention earlier this summer was a portion of the program where Dr. Stevens began to outline some of the issues surrounding the current state of the ADA. We felt that we could do no better than to invite Dr. Stevens to join us and talk a little bit about the need for, potentially, the ADA Restoration Act and some of the issues that are currently surrounding that act. And I suppose, in a sense as well, we will at the very least make some prognostications about the potential future of the Americans with Disabilities Act. Dr. Stevens, maybe you could begin by providing a two-minute or so overview of what the Americans with Disabilities Act is, and then we'll take it from there. But welcome to the program, and here is Dr. Stevens.
It's a pleasure to be with you, Paul, and with everyone else this evening. I hope you can hear me. I'll try to stay close to the microphone. An overview of the ADA in 1 or 2 minutes. I can simply say that this act was the culmination of major civil rights activity on behalf of people with disabilities, going all the way back, actually, to the late 1960s and reaching quite a level of momentum by the late 1980s. The act has several titles or sections, all titles. The three that are most important, titles 1, 2, and 3, deal essentially with employment, a provision of services by governmental entities, services and activities. That's title 2. And title 3 gets us into public accommodations largely by private entities. There are other provisions of the Act as well that deal with communication, accessibility, and the Act has been interpreted extensively by lower federal courts, the United States Supreme Court, and the current restoration effort is designed to restore a broader meaning of the Act in light of several Supreme Court decisions that these are not constitutional decisions now so much as statutory decisions that give a narrower scope to the Act than its sponsors thought it would have. Now, I'm going to stop at that point and see if I've hit anything that might be of interest or if you want me to say more.
You actually did precisely what I wanted you to do. And just before we get into the specifics of some of the areas covered by the ADA Restoration Act, I'd like us to focus on one issue. You mentioned that the ADA is a civil rights law. Now, there are a lot of people who would argue that the ADA gives all kinds of special privileges and special opportunities and provides money for people with disabilities. Is that in fact the case? And if it's not, Could you help us to understand what we mean by a civil rights law?
I'll try to do that. Yes, the ADA is basically modeled after civil rights laws passed during the 1960s and 70s, notably the Civil Rights Act of 1964, which deals primarily with race and nationality and discrimination based on religion, tries to remove that, and gender discrimination. The idea is to provide equal opportunities and equal access to people with disabilities, rather than to view disability as somehow requiring treatment. In other words, we've moved from what used to be referred to as a medical model to a civil rights model, where the emphasis really is on equal opportunity for individuals with disabilities. And, of course, the concept of reasonable accommodation is at the center of that concept, and that makes the ADA somewhat different from the traditional civil rights legislation. But it is definitely in the mainstream now, and I think most people see this, in the mainstream of civil rights law.
So essentially a civil rights law is something that says that while you don't have to do anything special, a person, all other things being equal, to do as much as anybody else should, and his disability ought not be the cause for his being prevented from doing things that other folks would do. Would you say that's a fair statement?
Yes, that's a very fair statement. That's exactly what the law is designed to do. It is designed to open up opportunity. It recognizes that people with disabilities constitute what the law calls a discrete and insular minority, meaning that this minority, suggesting that this minority has indeed been kept out of many of the opportunities, especially in employment and education and transportation also, that other people have enjoyed routinely. The emphasis here, again, is on access and opportunity and being treated with a standard or on the basis of a standard of equality.
So that takes us really to an analysis of what's happened when the ADA was signed on July 26, 1990 by President Bush. There was a huge amount of hope in the disability community that finally we had reached something close to nirvana, where suddenly and magically we would in fact see the rights of people with disabilities recognized and valued, and we would see the discrimination that it was generally agreed was pretty widespread gradually disappear. And everybody was predicting that the employment rate of people with disabilities would go up, that state and local governments would suddenly include people with disabilities in much of what they did, and that perhaps most significantly, private businesses in covered categories would for the first time truly open their businesses to make them available and open to people with disabilities. So the question, I suppose, that we need to ask is, in the 17 years or so that have passed since the ADA was passed, have people with disabilities got what they hoped for out of the ADA? And if not, perhaps you could explain to us why not.
The changes that were expected have not occurred. There have perhaps been some marginal improvements. There is perhaps a little bit more accessibility in some areas. As for employment, it doesn't seem that the Act has had the positive impact that many people thought it would have. And one of the reasons, and I'll just focus on one issue, that there are so many that we can't talk about all of them, but the most salient, I think, is that the Supreme Court, in a number of cases, but the Sutton case in 1999 is perhaps the leading example, the Supreme Court said that mitigating factors, that is, factors that would reduce the impact of a disability, essentially should be taken into account in determining whether a disability exists, so that if a person is treated for a disability and his situation improves, he may be regarded ultimately as not even having a disability as a result of the treatment. Many people with disabilities feel that that is the wrong approach, that that is not what Congress intended. And indeed, the ADA Restoration Act would change all that, would modify the Supreme Court's interpretation of the scope of the act. Congress can do that because we're not talking about a constitutional change. When the Supreme Court speaks on the Constitution, its words are final. But when it speaks on the meaning of statutes, Congress can change that simply by reenacting or amending the statute. And that's what they're considering now. And they've put language in the statute, the ADA Restoration Act, that would reject this narrow view that the Supreme Court has taken of disability. Let me stop there.
It's sort of interesting to me that we seem to be going in cycles. We had almost exactly the same thing happen with the previous effort at federal reform, which was the Rehabilitation Act of 1973, which eventually required Congress to fine-tune it later on, because the Reagan administration during the 1980s sought seriously to narrow the scope of the Rehab Act. So we seem to be faced with the same thing as each new law comes out. Interestingly enough, we don't appear to be facing the same kind of narrowing of scope as applied to civil rights as measured in the 1964 Act. It might be fascinating to explore why that is, but perhaps it's beyond the scope of where we are. So one of the ways, and I'm sorry, I probably shouldn't have said all that, one of the ways that the ADA Restoration Act then will operate is to reestablish the notion that having a disability per se has meaning and that there ought not to be additional tests. Sutton was one example. There was also the case, the one that seems to get quoted a lot in the blind community, of the two flight attendants who were sisters and who worked for an airline. If you can remember, perhaps you could tell us a little bit about that case.
Are you referring to the case in which, with corrective glasses, the plaintiff was able to see well enough to fly an airplane? I think that's Sutton. You're talking about a perhaps different case, and I may not know all the facts of the case that you're referring to, but that case, the one I was talking about, the court said that even though without corrective glasses the person was almost legally blind, the corrective use of glasses removed that disability, and the person could no longer be classified as having a disability. That's probably not the case you're referring to. I'm sorry, Paul, but I don't think I can talk confidence about the case you are referring to. There was the Toyota case in which an individual was said not to have a disability. She had carpal tunnel syndrome and was attempting to work on an assembly line and, of course, was hard-pressed to do it. And it was said that because she could perform ordinary functions of daily living, somehow the carpal tunnel syndrome could not classify or be classified as a disability. Also was seen as a rather unfortunate narrowing of congressional intent.
Yeah, actually, it was my mind slip and not yours. I was, in fact, referring to the Sutton case. Good job of describing it. I think, if I recall correctly, the other twist that operated with the Sutton case was that the real issue was that they weren't hired full-time on the basis that they had to use corrective lenses, and therefore, in their view, they felt that they clearly qualified as individuals who were being discriminated against on the basis of their disability, on the basis of limited vision, which required corrective lenses. And in effect, what the court says is, well, you know, if that were really the case, that'd be fine. But with corrective lenses, you see fine, so you don't qualify as having a disability. And it doesn't really matter why the airline didn't hire you or whether disability has anything to do with that. We don't even need to consider that because you don't have a disability and therefore, ipso facto, you don't qualify for utilizing the ADA as any part of your defense. Those were the kinds of argument that have narrowed definition. There have been some cases, though, where the ADA has been recognized as having some validity. And maybe to be fair, we ought to talk about perhaps a couple of those.
We are currently experiencing minor internet congestion, and some clipping or breakup of some words may occur. It should clear up momentarily.
The cases, I think, have been most positive under the ADA are under Title II, and the leading case here is Tennessee versus Lane, in which the court held by a 5-4 vote that access to the courts is a fundamental right, therefore requiring scrutiny on the part of challenging or testing the act. In other words, the fundamental right of access triggers what we call strict scrutiny, and the action of the state can be, it advances some compelling government interest. Well, the state of Tennessee really couldn't meet that test in not making courthouses accessible to people in wheelchairs who could not get up to the upper-level courthouses because no elevators existed in several courthouses around the state. Now, that case was 2004, and then in 2006, in the Goodman case from Georgia, we saw the court applying some of the thinking, the Lane case, to extend the Americans with Disabilities Act to situations in which people actually had their constitutional rights overtly violated. In that case, was a prisoner who was placed in very, very difficult and even dangerous situation. He was paraplegic in a small prison cell. There were hygiene issues, there were safety issues, and the prison would do nothing to correct the problem. As a result, the prisoner's attorney alleged that he was deprived of his Sixth Amendment right against an unusual punishment. And believe it or not, the Supreme Court unanimously upheld that clause, said, in other words, that he was processed under the Eighth Amendment, since this involved a direct violation of his constitutional rights, and it, of course, was tied strictly to Title II of the ADA. The author of that opinion was none other than Justice Antonin Scalia, who isn't often seen as a great champion of disability rights, but in this, he controlled Rice's decision.
Part of the problem, I guess, though, with even these positive decisions is that they were pretty narrow. So, for example, could we conclude from Tennessee versus Lane that state and local governments are now truly and categorically required under the ADA to assure access to every public building in a county where they have jurisdiction?
No, we cannot assume that. We cannot assume that Lane's any causes. We can argue that if a fundamental rights position can be clearly articulated, you can apply a Lane to it. And some argued, for example, that if access to the courts is a fundamental right, then what about voting? That's also been seen by the court as a fundamental right. And access to the polls, access to voting machines by people with disabilities might also flow from Lane. It hasn't yet, but it could. But it is a very narrow ruling. And we don't yet know what the implications of this Goodman case really are. The language that Scalia uses in that case is strange. He says if one's constitutional rights are really violated, if there is an actual violation, meaning, I suppose, some kind of overt action on the part of government to violate the rights of individuals, as was where the action was in requiring this prisoner to stay in a cell was unhealthy and unsafe. But we don't have much expectation that this court, as it is presently constituted, will go much further in protecting the rights of people with disabilities.
So essentially, part of the reason why Congress is intervening again is because of a belief that, I don't know if belief is too strong a word, but I think a belief that the balance of power of the courts has been moved towards the right and towards a more conservative interpretation of the Constitution, which is likely to preclude people with disabilities from receiving fair treatment from the court. So one of the factors that we can operate with before we end up with lots of constant law is to make some changes in the way that the law was supposedly intended to be written, and to outline and be specific about those components. So that's what's behind the legislation. Can you give us some other examples of some of the other things that the ADA Restoration Act would seek to do?
I'll certainly try to. For one thing, it reaffirms the dignity and worth of people with disability. It changes some language of the original act to reaffirm the idea that disability is a normal part of life of everybody, that everyone can expect to deal with disability, and that one's worth is not to be in any way diminished as a result of the disability. The language of the act is strengthened along those lines. That was said in the original act, but it's said emphatically in this act. It also defines disability much simply, as simply referring to a physical or mental impairment. It doesn't go to a lot of verbiage about the major life activities. I suppose that language is still there, perhaps, but it's been modified considerably and simplified so that it's very direct. And in defining disability, the statute refers to both physical and mental disabilities. The statute refers, I noticed, to mental retardation specifically as a disability, which is obviously, if not directly aimed at, it certainly falls specifically on a recent Court of Appeals decision out of the Fifth Circuit in Alabama, where the court, in effect, held, as I understood the case, that mental retardation couldn't be viewed in the context of that case as a disability protected by the ADA. The statute would certainly remove that doubt, remove that ambiguity. Those are just a couple of examples, Paul. I don't know how much time I have, but that may give you some idea.
Yeah, Otis, that's excellent. One of the issues that perplexed me as the ADA has unfolded was the application of states' rights amendments and other amendments to block the ADA. Does the ADA Restoration Act actually deal with this whole issue of whether the ADA rises to the level of being a significant enough issue to justify the federal government becoming directly involved?
Well, Congress cannot do anything directly to address the Supreme Court's decision that Title I, for example, does not extend to suits against the state if the state doesn't wish to be sued. In other words, the state's sovereign immunity, which was abrogated or abolished by the original ADA, was said by the U.S. Supreme Court in the Garrett case to not to be subject to limitation by Congress. Now, I know that the members of Congress who supported the act on constitutional grounds, and the best is to change the makeup of the Supreme Court. People on the court who are less inclined to a narrow view of the act, willing to recognize the power of college sovereign immunity. Chief Justice Rehnquist was really the architect of that particular approach. He is now gone, and I'm not sure that for very much longer is going to adhere to this narrow view of state sovereign immunity. But it could. One other thing to keep in mind here, and I've been thinking about this, we now have a Chief Justice who potentially has a disability. We don't know yet the extent to which Chief Justice Roberts' seizure may indicate a situation in which perhaps he himself could be classified as a person with a DA, but that, and that might change the whole landscape if that were true.
Yeah, it's fascinating. The issue that I was trying to get you to, let me see if I can do this. It seems to me that one of the things that we that began to see people saying about the was that there was sufficient evidence that people were so severely affected by as to rise above a concern that we were interfering with states' rights. And I guess my thought is that if Congress were to, in fact, write language in that reaffirmed its belief that they had reams and reams and reams and reams of evidence that suggested and meaningful and serious discrimination that was being practiced against people with disabilities every day, that was impacting their ability to live full and meaningful lives and was substantially limiting to the American dream, if you like, to the degree, for instance, that was equal with the position that Congress took with regard to some of the voting rights legislation in the 1960s. I guess that was how I saw Congress as acting, but perhaps I'm mistaken and perhaps they can't. So maybe you'd comment on that?
No, Paul, you're absolutely right. Congress can always ask the court, say it again. And there was a very strong argument in support of the ADA to the effect that discrimination against people with disabilities should be viewed essentially comparable to discrimination against women, at the very least, if not against African Americans. We might not rise to quite as high a level of scrutiny as we do with race cases, but the gender cases, which called for heightened scrutiny, in other words, the law would say that the presumption would be that any practice which excludes a person on the basis of disability would be presumed to be illegal, and that those who engage in that activity would have to show an important reason for the exclusion. Now, there's no reason why, which the Supreme Court, by the way, has rejected. The Supreme Court has never accepted the heightened scrutiny approach to disability discrimination. They view disability discrimination as subject to the same kind of standard that applies to economic discrimination, the old rational basis test, which means that the presumption is in favor of the classification and the burden is on the plaintiff who challenges that. What the court might be asked to do is to revisit that issue. It wouldn't be the first time that the court has been asked to re-examine one of its constitutional rulings. And if there is enough support out there to bring about a serious reevaluation of that question, the court could very easily go the other way. Again, with a couple of changes in personnel on the court, that could happen. So your question, Paul, is a very good one. The court can indeed be asked to reexamine even a constitutional interpretation.
I'm going to ask one other question, and it may be a question out of left field because you may not have had an opportunity to explore this question. One of the most recent developments with regard to the ADA Restoration Act was a position that was taken today by the Chamber of Commerce against the ADA Restoration Act, and they published a fairly lengthy letter exploring the reasons for their opposition, and I wonder if I might persuade you to comment on first the validity of their argument, if there is any, and second, on what impact you think this may have on the likelihood of the ADA Restoration Act to pass.
I haven't had a chance to look at the document that they have published, but it's not surprising. Many business entities don't want to make the modifications that are mandated by this statute that exaggerate the cost that is involved in providing reasonable accommodations, and they have traditionally opposed the extension of this legislation. So it's not surprising that they would take this position. It makes me realize the danger of opening up this legislation. If we open it up right now, given the strong anti-ADA sentiment that you'll find within many, not all, but many business circles and among conservative commentators, many of whom are all over the radio these days, this might not be the best time to be reopening this legislation, because if you open it up, there's always the chance that more restrictive language, such as the language that the Supreme Court has written, might in fact be incorporated into the statute. And we certainly, those of us who advocate disability rights, certainly would not want to see that happen. So I think there's some real danger here, Paul, in moving too quickly at a time when we have only about 150 or so people on record in Congress as supporting this legislation, to move ahead full blast with an attempt to get it changed.
that's always been the really tough question. I find myself in a slightly different position. I think the disability community a long time ago lost control of this legislation, frankly, by not standing up for it a lot sooner. And I think that you may well be correct, that the time at which we really can make meaningful changes may have passed.
From ACB Radio Mainstream, you're listening to Tuesday Topics. Once again, your host, Paul Edwards.
I'm going to open things up now to see if folks have some questions or some comments for Dr. Stevens. Otis, you've really done a masterful job of helping us to understand what's involved in the next few months. And you've made watching the progress of this bill through Congress much more fun. So let me open it up and see if people have some questions or comments that they'd like to raise with Dr. Stevens.
I'll be glad to take questions. I'm going to listen closely. And also, I'd like an opportunity to come back in a couple of months, Paul, if Brian will invite me, and talk a little bit more in depth about some additional cases. We talked about a few tonight, but there aren't many others that I would like to have time to go into. And we can also follow the legislation. We'll know a little bit more within 2 or 3 months how this thing is actually playing out.
Hi, this is Brian Collins from Long Beach, California. And I'm at the risk of sounding like I'm playing a semantics game. Something that I have heard said by a number of institutions is that the original ADA law and other laws that went before it were just another form of an affirmative action law. My question is how much truth is that? Your statements earlier in the program about it being a civil rights law, I'm just curious, is that just another way of saying affirmative action? And is the ADA law an affirmative action law?
Depending on how you define affirmative action, and I don't view affirmative action as a bad word, those who use that language generally are opposed to affirmative action. I would say that the charge that it is affirmative action has to do with the necessity of making reasonable accommodations. But we have never, under the ADA, suggested anything like quotas or timetables, to my knowledge, for people with disabilities to be employed in certain occupations or to lower standards for participation in jobs or for admission to the bar or any such thing. Reasonable accommodation, as I see it, is designed to level the playing field, not to provide extra advantages to people with disabilities, but to enable them to compete on equal or more nearly equal terms with other people. That is often said to be affirmative action, but I don't see affirmative action in the concept of reasonable accommodation at all. I think there's a bum rap that the critics have managed to level at the ADA, but I strongly oppose that view.
Hello, this is Gary Wood. I think that all of us who are disabled should be behind the ADA revision. I do have a question, though. Since the Supreme Court does seem to be leaning to the right with some, I mean, if some of the ones that are older pass on who are the liberal element, do you feel that that's going to hurt our chances for the ADA?
If those older people like Stevens and Ginsburg retire or die and are replaced by people like Samuel Alito or Clarence Thomas, yes. The act will probably be given even narrower interpretation. However, the process of appointing people to the Supreme Court depends on who is in the Senate and who is. If you have a less conservative person in the White House, be that person a Republican or Democrat, doesn't make any difference necessarily with respect to party. If you have a less, quote, conservative, unquote, person in the White House, and you retain and maybe enlarge a more moderate to liberal majority in the Senate, the chances are that another Alito or another Thomas will not be appointed to the court in the near future. That's what many people are banking on who think that the court has moved too far to the right. You know, 30 years ago, there were people who thought the court had moved too far to the left. Now I think the general feeling by a lot of people, including a lot of folks who are strongly ideological, that the court has moved too far in the other direction and that we may need some kind of leveling off here.
I think it might be a good idea, since we've thrown this word around, reasonable accommodations, for us to spend a couple of minutes defining it. Let me take a first stab, and then perhaps you can add a little. It seems to me that the core value that operates behind the idea of reasonable accommodations is it says if a person is equally qualified for a service or for a job, but needs some accommodations to be made in order to make that service or that job fully available to him or her, then those accommodations need to be made. And really, that's all that reasonable accommodations is. It doesn't say that any disabled person needs to be hired ever. It simply says if a disabled person is equally qualified, an entity cannot back away from the expenditure of some dollars in order to provide accommodations that enable that individual to perform the essential functions of the job, if we look at it from its employment component element. Does that get pretty close, Dr. Stevens, to the way you would define reasonable accommodations? And would you add some stuff?
Paul, that's a very good definition of reasonable accommodation. The idea, as you say, is to enable the person to perform a job which he is qualified to perform in a way that enables him to be competitive with other people. And the idea, of course, is not to give that person any advantage over anyone else, and certainly not to force the hiring of anyone or the licensure of anyone, but simply to enable that person to accomplish what he is qualified to accomplish. And it can be true in employment, it can be true in education as well. For example, additional time on a bar examination for a visually impaired person doesn't mean that the individual doesn't have to pass the bar. They're not changing the questions for the visually impaired person. They're simply giving him or her a chance to compete in completing that examination with people who can move a lot faster most of the time with their eyes than many of us can with our fingers if we're reading Braille copy of the bar exam. I had that rather unhappy experience of trying to read the bar exam in Braille with two hands and then typing my answers as best I could. It was hard to do, and in those days they didn't give us much in the way of additional time, and it was a rough experience for me, and it has been for many other people. That doesn't mean that we're trying to obtain advantages over other people, but rather to be able to compete on more or less equal terms with those people.
Hi, Otis and Paul. Sue Amateur. The other thing it doesn't mean under reasonable accommodation, even though you talk about this in court cases, is that people can't engage in behavior that's inappropriate. So if I act out in the office and throw things and blah, 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 and later say, oh, that was because of my disability, you act inappropriately in the office, and first should be disciplined, and then counseling could be offered to change the behavior. But I think in some court cases that have led people to have erroneous assumptions about the ADA. And my second comment, that the justice that you mentioned with the disability, it can probably be a two-edged sword. He could either become more empathetic, let's hope, or he'd go the other way, which some newly disabled people do, and say, well, I did it, so can they.
Very good comment, Sue. And you're right about that's another example of what the ADA does not require. And I'll let Paul answer the question about the availability of the program, but those are good comments.
Yeah, I think they're excellent comments, and certainly they apply just as much to educational environments like the ones in which I work, Sue. One of the amazing things is it used to be that you could demonstrate that an individual had a disability by looking at documentation. You can't do that even in the educational setting anymore because of the Supreme Court decisions. And maybe this will help folks to understand exactly why the ADA Restoration Act is so important. What we are required to do in places like disability service components of colleges and universities is to not only demonstrate that a person has an obvious disability that would entitle him to specific changes, but we then need to conduct an in-person interview that explores in depth precisely what his functional limitations may be, and those have become as important as the disability itself in determining the kinds of accommodations to which that individual is entitled. For those of us who are trying to interpret things, it becomes something of a nightmare because you're no longer on the firm ground of having a clear disability. Even in areas as simple as extra time on bar exams, what we're seeing nowadays are entities who are making those decisions requiring an absolutely unconscionable amount of information from blind people. I looked at a blind person who was required to provide a complete listing of every test for which he received accommodation and every test for which he didn't before they would determine whether or not he qualified for extra time. It's absolutely ludicrous.
Good evening, all. This is Dave McElroy speaking, and I really don't know where I truly stand on this whole ADA issue. I think we've lost, definitely lost focus. And the problem is, in my estimation, twofold. One, everybody, and I mean everybody, even with a hangnail, wants to be considered disabled until such time as the real inconvenience of disability strikes, and then all of a sudden they don't want to be disabled anymore. And I think this is probably part and parcel of where the Supreme Court has been feeling itself having to go over this time. But the second thing is unfortunately our problem. And it would be most well described in an incident that I was witness to a couple of days ago in another chat room. Essentially what had happened was a woman was treated badly on a Greyhound bus by the driver. Now, what apparently happened was she demanded that he take her to a restroom in a small McDonald's, and he told her that he didn't have time. Anyway, it was unpleasant at best, but she was romping and stomping and saying that she was going to complain under ADA, and he had to do this, and he had to do that. You know, I told her, I said, look, He didn't have to be nice to you. You know, ADA does not demand that the person is nice to you. If they're a nasty person, they're a nasty person. And, I think we think ADA is going to solve all our problems. It's not. It doesn't. It won't.
I could not agree with you more. There is a widespread perception out there, and it's based on some reality, as you suggest, that there are those people who assume that anything that gives them discomfort or that is unpleasant to them gives them the right to invoke ADA provisions and to raise Cain, as you were saying. That certainly is a counterproductive position to take. The ADA was never intended to be used in that way. And those people, even if they represent a small minority among people with disabilities, make a lot of noise and further reinforce the negative attitudes, especially of business people who are somewhat resistant to the law, many of them at least, to begin with. So I think the point you're making is very, very valid, and one that we as people with disabilities need to do something to counteract insofar as we can.
This is Brian Collins again. There's an awful lot of energy that those of us who have a certain kind of disability, such as this person with low vision or a hearing impairment and others, disabilities, we have to go through this incredible amount of energy in order to prove or verify our disability. Would the current changes in the verbiage in the reformed ADA lessen any of that? Sometimes people, I believe, are being told that they're not disabled simply because they don't know how to prove or verify it, and others who are still relatively new to it or just inexperienced in discussing it. Is there a definite way to maybe put something like this before a body of legislators in order to ask the question, is the verbiage going to help or hurt those with limited disabilities and not severe disabilities? My reason for asking this is if a person who is an African American says he's an African American, can anybody argue with him? The question is If a person with a disability says he has a disability, can and should anybody have the authority to argue with him and tell him, no, he doesn't?
This is Sue. I hope I can interject for a minute. At least when I was working in the field, if there was any doubt of the existence of a disability, people could be asked for documentation. Obviously, if somebody walked into my office with a guide dog, I'm not going to make them prove that they're blind or if they're in a wheelchair. But there are a lot of invisible disabilities that you certainly can ask for documentation. And that's even true in the arena of race. If somebody says, for affirmative action purposes, I want to be considered African American, and you have reason to question it by their appearance or such, you can ask for documentation.
Yeah, I don't know how much we can improve the situation. The language of the Restoration Act, and I strongly favor this Restoration Act and hope it can be passed. My earlier comments were just that I'm not sure about the timing of making this effort. In any event, there is an attempt in this statute to simplify the language and simply to talk about physical and mental impairments. But the term impairment is itself vague, so I don't know how much we can improve on things simply with words, and I don't know whether we can ever get rid of at least some requirement of documentation. Now, the excessive documentation requirement, of course, can involve harassment of the individual and really may be an abuse of process, which suggests negative feelings toward the person with a disability to begin with. And I don't know how we deal with that other than to flag it, criticize it, as many people are doing here this evening, when it arises, and get the word out that excessive requirements of documentation really go against the spirit of the law. The language of the revised statute clearly is aimed at simplifying and making it easier to establish the existence of a disability. But whether it will actually have that effect, I don't know. The definition of disability under the ADA, of course, is very broad, and many people feel that that's one of the problems of the statute. Many people feel that medical conditions, which are now viewed as disabilities, really shouldn't be covered by the Act at all. And there's an argument to be made for that, certainly. And, of course, there are always people who are going to take advantage of any situation to try to obtain the benefits that they think will flow from being classified in this way, like people who seek to be qualified for Social Security disability, who may in fact not be disabled in any meaningful way. It's just a problem that we have in the political process, in our democratic society, the give and take of interest groups, and all I can say is that we can look at least to try to have Congress make the language of the statute a little bit more direct and open and unconvoluted. And I think that's one improvement that the Restoration Act has made. I don't know if you've seen the bills or not, but they are easily available online. And you can read for yourselves the provisions that are out there and see if you think they really do improve the situation. I think they're a little better, frankly.
This is Brian from Boston, Massachusetts. Couple of things. First off, I want our listeners to know a little bit about where ACB currently stands with respect to the ADA Restoration Act. I spoke with folks at the National Office this afternoon, and they indicate that the Board of Directors of ACB have passed a motion indicating that ACB favors the ADA Restoration Act, but that we are not currently going to join in any coalitions advocating for its passage. Rather, we would like to be able to be at the table as the language develops, because, of course, there's a Senate version, a House version, and the House version has been referred to four separate committees. So many, many people are going to be looking at this, amending this over the course of time. I know they were hoping to get something up and through by the end of October, but that seems highly unlikely at this point. Certainly, it's got many more sponsors on the House side than it does on the Senate side at this point. So there's quite a bit of support that needs to be drummed up for this kind of discussion on the Senate side of things. A couple of places where I've run into problems with the ADA, a difficult ways that either the Department of Justice or court cases have caused us to interpret things. One is in getting access to accommodations at public places like ballparks. But the Justice Department indicates that places of public accommodation cannot require an individual to prove their disability when they request accommodation as a result of that disability. This has caused parks to really pull back on offering any kind of service to persons with disabilities in terms of ticketing, because individuals claim they have a disability and buy disability seats and then be scalpers and sell those on the secondary market. I wonder, is there anything in the Restoration Act that would allow entities to have a better understanding of what they can request of an individual to provide to verify their disability when seeking accommodation?
I don't think there's anything there that would be specifically addressed to that question, Brian. I've read the both versions, both Senate and House versions, and I don't really think they address that problem directly. But I'd have to go back and look closely with that question in mind.
I think the other thing that we probably need to put into the equation, there are so many things that people say about the ADA which, for the most part, aren't true. I want us to be careful as we're looking at the ADA Restoration Act to look at what is real rather than what is supposed. It is possible for an individual with a hangnail to claim that he has a disability. It has never been the case where any court has come close to recognizing that a person with a hangnail has one. If anything, the courts have been extremely strong at saying that an individual must demonstrate that disability fundamentally limits their ability to operate with one or more major life activity. And clearly a person with a hangnail couldn't demonstrate that. And it's never been demonstrated. A person who is drunk is specifically excluded from the Americans with Disabilities Act. They're categorically not covered. An individual who suffers from alcoholism and who is in a rehab program is coverable under the ADA. But once that individual gets drunk, he is no longer covered. A person with HIV would not be considered to have a disability until and unless that individual was ill enough for one or more of his daily life activities to be substantially limited. And yet, here we have three statements that Gary makes that are common statements and that we've heard already tonight that clearly color the way other people see the ADA. And we've got to somehow guard against that. And maybe, Dr. Stevens, you could tell us how we can do that, because, boy, I sure don't know.
I wish I did, but think of a court that refused, a court of appeals that refused to recognize a disability in a person's carpal tunnel syndrome, which actually did interfere with her ability to do the assembly line job that she had. And all she was asking for was some accommodation. She was not asking that the requirements of the job be removed, but she was asking for some accommodation, perhaps a lowering of the level, the height at which she had to do the polishing of automobiles as they came through the assembly line. And yet the court there refused to recognize that she had a disability because she could hold her baby in her arms, she could brush her teeth, she could do other, she could perform other functions of daily living, and the court found that because she could do those things, she couldn't be thought of as having a disability. So I don't think the problem really is one of courts defining disability too broadly at all. Now, some people may think that courts do that, but rarely would a court ever go beyond the meaning that I think Congress had in mind when it passed this act. If anything, courts these days are inclined to go in the other direction.
This is Sue, and I want to interject, but I have to tell you, having viewed people with carpal tunnel and other things, that I used to think, well, that's not really disabling. Boy, give me blindness any day. I realize we face different societal factors, but when someone can't even brush their teeth or do some personal functions, that's just as disabling as not having vision. they may not face the societal issues that we do, but it's still in the context of a disability, a disability.
I think also that the carpal tunnel can be pretty serious, and in this case, the woman was really being prevented from performing her job without some kind of accommodation. And while it's not as earth-shaking as some disabilities, it was not trivial either.
Ladies and gentlemen, we have actually reached the point at which we're going to need to end tonight's program. Earlier in the program, Dr. Stevens indicated he would like to come back in a couple of months. I think that we can probably promise Dr. Stevens that he would be welcome to come back in a single month and talk about some of these other cases, and then come back in 2 months so that we can then explore together where the ADA Restoration Act is in fact going by then, because I think by the end of October we'll have a pretty good idea. I would certainly, and I suspect Brian would agree, love to have you back to discuss some of the other cases that have come along with regard to the ADA. There are an awful lot of really important ones that we just haven't had a chance to talk about at all. And some of those really help to answer some of the questions about what disability ought to be and what's covered and what's not. So on behalf of all of us at Tuesday Topics, Dr. Stevens, we'd like to thank you so much for being our guest this evening. Let me give you an opportunity for a couple of final words, and then we will end our program for the evening.
Well, thank you, Paul. I would like to come back in about a month and do a little case review. I think that would be helpful to me to put these things in perspective and to get the reactions of people. This has been an excellent discussion this evening, and I realize that there are many points of view which are certainly worthy of consideration. We don't all agree on all aspects of the ADA. I think, generally speaking, we want to see more opportunities for people with disabilities, and that ultimately is the goal here. But I would welcome the opportunity to come back in a month and do a little case review, and I would say that this group is a very well-informed group, and I have appreciated your comments this evening. So thank you very much, Paul and Brian, and I look forward in about a month to coming back and giving as much as I can of a little case review here of major decisions going beyond Sutton and Lane and Goodman versus Georgia and a few other big ones, to talk about the nuts and bolts of the controversy going on in the courts and in Congress. Thank you.
Thank you very much for being with us, Dr. Stevens, and thanks everyone for participating and for listening. I think I've certainly learned lots about the ADA, and I appreciate the opportunity to do that. Please join us again next week on Tuesday Topics, and keep listening to ACB Radio, where there is often fallout, but where the radio remains active. Good night.
To participate in the recording of Tuesday Topics, we invite you to join us on Tuesday evenings in the U.S. at 9 p.m. Eastern. That's Wednesday, 1 hour Universal Time. The program is recorded in the Our Place Politics chat room at ourplace.acbradio.org. All you need is a microphone that is plugged into your computer sound card. A few minutes before each show begins, those online will be happy to assist with audio checks and to answer questions about the chat room service and how it works. An announcement promoting the topic to be discussed will be emailed to the ACB Radio Friends list early each week. So we hope you will come and join us Tuesday each week when Tuesday Topics is being recorded. Again, the URL is ourplace.acbradio.org.